Welcome to a podcast of a sermon delivered at the Unitarian Society of Ridgewood in New Jersey. Our congregation is a place where you will find inspiration in the richness of diverse beliefs and the power of community. Detailed information about the Unitarian Society of Ridgewood is available on our website, uuridgewood.org.
So this past winter, I attended a conference on religion, sexuality, and politics. One of the presenters showed the website Funny or Die's video, Prop 8, the musical. The video opens with a group of colorfully dressed performers. They sing, "It's a bright new brand Obama day. What a time to be black, a girl, or gay. No, nothing could go wrong, so join us in this song of happy days for the day for the gays. No, nothing can go wrong." Well, these lines, as I recite them today, in the middle of New York City Pride Weekend, the middle of Pride Month, these words are bittersweet. They are bittersweet in the face of the attempted rollback of human rights from far too many corners. And yet it is not just today's bitterness that I want us to consider. There was a darker truth in this video, even when it did feel like it was a bright new brand Obama day. There was a sourness that we as faithful people must address if a truly new day is going to emerge from the dark places we find ourselves in. As the video continues, the singing gays and liberals are interrupted by a crowd of religious people, all dressed in black, who tell voters that the gays will teach their children about sodomy. The colorfully dressed good liberals are appalled. Jack Black, dressed as Jesus, appears and implores his followers to choose love instead of hate. But then the real savior comes out. The best of all the good gays, Neil Patrick Harris. To some of you, Doogie Howser, M.D., to others, Barney Stinson, to those Broadway lovers like myself, the best Tony Awards host ever, NPH, our salvific song and dance man, wheels out on a piano, gets up, and sings us the real reason to support gay marriage. Every time a gay or lesbian finds love at the parade, there's money to be made. By the end, people are waving American flags and everyone on stage is singing with Harris, "I can see America's calling me. Yes, gay marriages will save the economy." No statement could be more reflective of where we as a society have come to define value, and so rest morally. The search for more wealth is our plan of holy discipleship, and the God of uninterrupted growth, the master we serve. Even we good liberals may too often define societal worth, our own liberation, with money to be made, social capital. Money defines value and through its promissory nature, as in the promise that one day I will have enough money, or in other words, one day I will finally be enough. Money holds us in suspense of achieving worth. The divinity of money fortifies a future-focused hope akin to what Lauren Berlant has diagnosed as cruel optimism. Optimism isn't of itself cruel, but a relation of cruel optimism exists when something you desire is actually an obstacle to your flourishing. In other words, instead of asking how we might flourish today, we work ourselves to death so that someday, one day, we might flourish. For if, as the saying goes, time is money, then we have to use our time wisely by saving as much of it as possible. Our hours need to be spent productively, profitably. We bring our laptops on the bus so that travel time is also work time. We don't saunter errands, we run them. No one ever says, "You wouldn't believe what a great unitasker Jenny is." Conversely, spending time to play, to make love, to lie in the grass and just be places us into debt. To spend time unproductively, neoliberalism tells us, is to have wasted our time. Even as we are held in suspense of the moneyed kingdom to come, we must be ever more efficient producers of that promised wealth. By promising its fulfillment in a nearly unattainable state of future wealth, the divinity of money holds our current flourishing at bay. And perhaps worse, it marks far too many of us as not worthy of saving at all. Indeed, whom and what have we been willing to sacrifice at the altar of the god of unregulated, unending, unwieldy growth? Philosopher Max Weber warned us about such worship when he coined the terms the Protestant work ethic and the spirit of capitalism. The early Protestants aligned hard work, employment, and wealth as outward signs of inward holiness. In other words, one's worth was inextricably tied to one's work. If you were poor or struggling, it could only be that you were disfavored by God, that you were a fallen man. The poor as fallen, as sinful, as worthy of disgrace. Sound familiar? Weber noted that even as Western societies became more secular, this emphasis on work as a sign of worth, the need to deem some souls as elect and condemn others, continued. And in America, we see this everywhere. False narratives of meritocracy that assume if you have wealth, you deserve it. And if you don't, you don't. If you don't, you are justly marked as disposable. Society is not sinful, not ill, not backwards, not broken. You are. I name such narratives neoliberal redemption stories. The more productive, the more efficient, the faster we are, the better the chance we will have to reach that promised land, to be saved out of the wretched existence of being disposable, of being unnecessary for money to be made. Perhaps our fate is even worse. Perhaps it is our very disposal, our downfall, and our desperate attempts to be redeemed through disaster capitalist practices like predatory payday lenders, or through more pills to make us sleep faster and so wake, able to do more, through markets of rehabilitation that take our damage and make it profitable. Perhaps our disposal is the only thing we have left of value. And yet, what is really being redeemed when we work ourselves to death? Who profits when we desperately run from how bad our lifestyles, our jobs, our consumption have made us feel? When we cover over the pain of what it is to live in this society, when we numb ourselves through drugs or booze or shopping or Netflix or never stop going, 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 because if we sit still too long, we might actually question what worth, what kinds of real wealth we still have left. We do everything we can to prove our electability, our productive worth to society, to keep growing, be profitable investments, because there's nothing worse in America than being marked as irredeemable by capitalism, to be considered a bad investment, to have perhaps some pre-existing conditions. Today, all parts of life, not just the days spent at paid labor, are measured by profitability. For instance, recently Facebook was praised for offering to pay for female employees to freeze and store their eggs. This was seen as a recognition of the various demands placed on women of childbearing age. And yet, we might also read such a perk as a demand that one continues to work for Facebook during one's most productive years. The company need not make room for people with children, you know, like paid family leave, flexible hours. No, the message is clear. Wait to have those little distractions from work when you are past your laboring prime. The work ethic now demands hands, heart, head, and ovum. Perhaps a more overtly harsh work ethic is that employed by Jeff Bezos at Amazon. According to a recent New York Times article, at Amazon, workers are encouraged to tear apart one another's ideas in meetings, toil long and late, emails arrive past midnight, followed by text messages asking why they were not answered, and held to standards that the company boasts are unreasonably high. The internal phone directory instructs colleagues on how to send secret feedback to one another's bosses. The tool offers sample texts, including this one. I felt concerned about his inflexibility and openly complaining about minor tasks. The culture in which such demands on performance and acts of surveillance become naturalized operates under Bezos's principles of work, which include number 8, a bias for action, which affirms that speed matters for business and that calculated risks are better than slowing down to get more information. In the Times article, current and former employees describe various levels of burnout, seeing at least one person cry at their desks every day, being bullied about taking off time to treat cancer, and being pushed out after having miscarried twins, even though the person in question left for a business trip the next day, because being at a place in life where she was trying to start a family would be too much of a distraction from the speed needed at work. So why would these people stay? Why put oneself through this? And it's here that the effects of a narrative of productivity as your salvation becomes apparent. According to former employees, it was precisely the impossibility of achieving what Amazon demanded that became definitional for their sense of worth. Only the strong survive at Amazon. So if one has survived, she must be one of the elect. If you're a good Amazonian, you become an Amabot, a term that means you have become one with the system. This is the Protestant work ethic on digital steroids. Productivity trumps humanness. Flexibility trumps grace. And we have fallen for it too. Perhaps you have not ratted out a coworker for being inflexible, but I bet you have felt the pressure to be more pliable yourself, more useful, more efficient in all kinds of everyday ways. This narrative of individual resilience, where only the strong survive and the speedy prosper, where we must become our work, is one critiqued by feminist theorist Robin James. According to James, only certain people from within marginalized groups, women, people of color, queer folk, the disabled, are deemed profitable enough for the market to be temporarily saved out of their disposability. For instance, coming back to work after a miscarriage to prove you are still worthy is not only feeding into a narrative that says you are one of the resilient few, the elect, but it also marks all the rest of us who are not ready to come back as unworthy of the task, and ignores how problematic it is for a company or a society to demand that we overlook our pain for the health of its profits. James calls this the "look, I overcame" narrative. The "look, I overcame" narrative can be found whenever we point to an individual successful person from a marginalized group to prove that America really is a meritocracy. You can do it. We must be post-racial. Look at Beyonce and Obama. We must be post-patriarchy. Look at Sheryl Sandberg. We must be post-homophobia. Just look at all the good gays saving the economy by getting married. If they can do it, why can't you? Clearly, it's not the system that's broken. It's those of you unable to be productive members of society, unwilling to lean in far enough. What a time to be black, a girl, or gay. There's no need to worry why any of us were asked to overcome in the first place. And here's my problem with the Prop 8 video. As long as we have decided that profitability is our mark of election, then we will continue to make sacrifices at that altar. We will sacrifice the wealth of our time, time with family, time to create, time to rest, and we will sacrifice all those that the market does not know what to do with, the most precariously disabled, the mentally ill, the queer man and the straight woman who do talk about sodomy, the black man that no matter what he does is still marked as killable. These unprofitable, unruly, ill-behaved members are the unholy, the irredeemable. As long as we are convinced that somehow we earned our place in society, that we overcame our damage, so why can't they? As long as we keep going, going, going the way we are, fueling the machine that pits the good liberals, the good women, the good gays, the good people of color, the good worker against those still struggling, then we're lost. We are lost morally, but we are also lost physically. According to Naomi Klein, it is in the service of feeding the god of economic growth via the altar of what she calls hyperconsumption that hinders our attempts to slow down disastrous climate change. And just like the Protestant work ethic, the god of hyperconsumption has marked some unworthy of saving. Klein writes, "Running an economy on energy sources that release poisons as an unavoidable part of that extraction and refining has always required sacrifice zones, whole subsets of humanity categorized as less than fully human, which made their poisoning in the name of progress somehow acceptable. Through various feats of denialism and racism, it was possible for privileged people in North America and Europe to mentally cordon off these unlucky places as hinterlands, wastelands, nowheres. Zones of sacrifice are formed through a theology that names profit as salvation, assumes consumption and conquest are divinely sanctioned, and marks far too many of us as abject waste, and so disposable. This theology views the earth as such waste, but to those bodies historically aligned with earthliness, people of color, indigenous communities, women, the global south, the poor. Our neoliberal redemption narratives form hierarchies of capacity and debility, of liveliness and deathliness, such that those considered healthy, productive, and able have a life, whereas those targeted for premature or slow death are figured as debility. This poses the question, which bodies are made to pay for your progress? How many children are you willing to kill? Please name the specific children. Climate change is perhaps our greatest indictment of the sinfulness of the god of economic growth, and it is also those resisting this climate action that I think can teach us a better narrative, show us a new day. According to Klein, the communities that make up Blockadia, a growing movement of climate activists, they are increasingly saying no. No to the pipeline, no to Arctic drilling, no to the coal and oil trains, no to heavy hauls, no to the export terminal, no to fracking, and not just not in my backyard, but as the French say, neither here nor elsewhere. In other words, no new carbon frontiers. If we are to face the darkness of our day, we must realize we were always on the butcher's bill. We were always someday going to be sacrificed. We can't run away anymore from how those in power see most of us here as disposable. We must join in this no. It is a holy no, a holy blockage. We can stop up the machine that has been killing us. We can constipate the growth of the market, slowing it down long enough to imagine another way. This new way, I argue, comes not from a bias toward action, but rather a bias toward time. Time to love, time to create, time to just be. To be in holy in our blockage requires that we slow down enough to see who and what we are serving and whom and what we are sacrificing when we choose efficiency over affection. Such a slowdown must happen in truly restful and in fiercely unrestful ways. It happens whenever we refuse to work late with no pay, or when we stay in bed and feel the weight of the despair of the world, and not just rush to numb that weight so that we might get back to contributing to the machineries that caused the despair in the first place. Such holy blockage can also happen in much more active ways. Active demands for living wages and family leave policies that mean we will have more time to spend outside of work. New programs like that in France known as selective degrowth, where policies are put into place to democratize the availability of free time and to place resources in low carbon producing and caregiving fields. In Prosperity Without Growth, Tim Jackson notes that such degrowth would mean that the time spent directly improves the quality of our lives. Making professions more and more efficient is not, after a certain point, actually desirable. What sense does it make to ask our teachers to teach ever bigger and bigger classes, or our doctors to treat ever more and more patients in a smaller amount of time? Klein, drawing on Jackson, writes, there could be other benefits to slowdown, like shorter work hours, in part to create more jobs, but also because overworked people have less time to engage in low consumption activities, like gardening and cooking. The more you need to work, the less is possible for you to slow down. In other words, we are moving too quickly to see that all this speed is what's killing us. These proposals, shorter work hours, less efficient professions, to the American ear, they sound impossible, even sinful. But need they be? If we change the narrative, change the story that aligns our worth with our paid work, that says time is money, might we be willing to embrace such a slowdown, to redefine wealth not as growth, but as flourishing? This degrowth will take persistence. Sometimes it will take literally lying down on the front lines at the feet of the priests of consumption, blocking up those that would sacrifice far too many of us for their salvation. To become a blockage, therefore, is also to become standing rock, to refuse to be moved from holy land. It is to die in with the dozens of disabled protesters in front of Mitch McConnell's office, refusing the legalization of literal human sacrifice for profit. It is to say enough. No new carbon frontiers. No new payday lenders. No more money to be made. Not off of me and not off of us. In a roundtable discussion on precarity, queer theorist Judith Butler ponders the political significance of assembling as bodies, stopping traffic, or claiming attention. She asks whether instead of saying we are here, might these actions actually be saying we are still here, meaning we have not yet been disposed of. She writes, bodies on the street are precarious. They are exposed to police force and sometimes endure physical suffering as a result. But those bodies are also obdurate and persisting, insisting on their continued and collective there-ness. To form a blockage, to constipate the machine, to slow ourselves and it down, is not an act of impeding for impeding's sake. It is an act of prophetic witness. It is a call to pay attention to all those, like the disabled at Mitch McConnell's office, whom the powers that be wished would stay hidden, or perhaps just die off, but whose there-ness still matters. It is the holy persistence that they, that we might rise up not as individuals overcoming by ransoming others as irredeemable, but as a collective tide, sometimes as a restful resistance, refusing to get out of bed, refusing to cover over our pain, and sometimes as a fierce, unresting resistance, refusing to be moved, to be removed from the public sphere in the face of the pain of others. In her retelling of the biblical story of Jephthah's daughter, whose father must kill her as a result of a bargain, a calculation with God, a child whom, unlike the male child Isaac, goes unredeemed. Alicia Ostreicher gives Jephthah's daughter the following words. Yes, we are born into a theater of war. Yes, the violence of my father is a mirror he holds to the face of God. Yes, I am weeping. Yes, what else do you want of me? You who lament, you are the one. You be my angel. You be my messenger. You stop the warrior's hand. We too were born into a theater of war, a theater of calculation. How much poison are you willing to eat? Please name the poisons. It is a war on our time and our psyches and our souls and our communities and on our planet. We will not be able to block the warrior's hand alone. We must lay down our swords in the fight to prove our individual worth and become a rising lament. We must refuse to be productive and efficient at any cost, placing our bodies on the front lines, being willing to be unprofessional, to be made more precarious, in order to persist with those considered disposable. This can be the mirror we hold to the face of God. This can be our holy no. No more carbon frontiers. No more sacrifice zones. No more ransomed others on the road to my redemption. No more money to be made.